Hey guys, welcome to the first episode of our podcast, and it is called A Matter of Crime. It is an historical true crime podcast. My name is Allie.
I'm Chris.
And that's my husband, and this is our podcast. So the kind of things that we find interesting are historical events. I am getting my master's degree in history right now, and Chris is a huge history buff. So we wanted to cover true crime that was also historical and not necessarily things that you hear on some of the more popular true crime podcasts, things like assassinations and crimes of war and famous crimes that, you know, may have happened a long time ago but are still super interesting. So here we go. This is our first episode, so forgive us if there are any weird points or any mistakes.
And there surely will be.
Yeah, for sure. So our first episode is about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. Charles Lindbergh, who was also known as Lindy, was born in Detroit, Michigan on February 4th, 1902. He was a famous American aviator and had a history in the military. He became instantly famous in May of 1927 for making the first solo, nonstop transatlantic flight from New York to Paris. He made the flight alone in a single-engine plane, and it took 33 and a half hours. After his flight, he was quoted as saying, "There were times in an airplane when it seemed I had escaped mortality to look down on Earth like a god." So I think you could say that he was kind of full of himself. He was very handsome, and after his flight,
Whoa. Are you looking at the same picture I look at? He's not handsome.
He kind of looks like JFK.
Not on his best day, but continue.
Okay. Beg to differ.
It's like a foot. Go ahead.
So after his flight, by 1927 standards, he was handsome, and he became a household name, and he even had songs written about him, which is kind of weird. Before the Americans got involved in World War II, he was actually a German sympathizer and was supportive of pre-Nazi parties. He resigned from the military after President Roosevelt publicly called him out for his views. And that's important later, so just remember that. He switched sides after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and he flew 50 missions in the Pacific Theater as a civilian consultant. However, Roosevelt would not reinstate his commission because of his previous anti-war views. Do you want to give them a little bit of information about the Pacific Theater?
Well, that's a very large and broad subject. Do you mean just simply information about
what it was?
What it was?
Just a real quick,
A snapshot.
Yes.
Obviously, there were two major fronts: the European, and after which we put most of our resources at first on the European theater, because obviously Hitler. That's a whole nother podcast, but anyway, and then once he was defeated is when we shifted all resources basically to the Pacific Theater, which began an island hopping campaign to over the Imperial Japanese Navy and so on and so forth. But as far as that goes, that of course, Pearl Harbor, you know, the Japanese, when they attacked, you know, they really wanted to get all of our aircraft carriers. They were not in Pearl at that time, but they did devastating damage to our a lot of our battleships and Hickam Field and so on and so forth. But it's not about that right now. But
so the Pacific Theater that Lindbergh helped in was just the Japanese front of World War II. Basically, yes, in a short roundabout way.
As I understand it, he was, you know, his aviation skills were broad, and he, you know, and that was the birth of wars being fought with airplanes, you know, as far as aircraft carriers. I mean, that was what began it all, and his knowledge was vast as far as aircraft, and he was very, very intelligent and helped developing or finding problems and working those out. So that's where he contributed a lot in that theater.
And he was super cute, so. There. No? Okay.
No.
Okay, well, and back before the war, in December of 27, which is just a few months after his flight, which took place in May, he met Anne Morrow, who was a senior at Smith College. And the official story of how they got together was that they were introduced by their fathers. Her dad worked at J.P. Morgan as Charles's father's financial advisor. However, he was actually dating her older sister, Elizabeth, whom he dumped 6 months after meeting Anne. So a little family scandal.
Maybe it was accepted like that back then.
Okay, just found the other one cuter and was like, there I'm going with that. Okay, cool. She actually wrote about him in her journal, and I found this quote, which is a little creepy, but she said, "He is taller than anyone else. You see his head in a moving crowd, and you notice his glance, where it turns, as though it were keener, clearer, and brighter than anyone else's, lit with a more intense fire. What could I say to this boy? Anything I might say would be trivial and superficial, like pink frosting flowers. I felt the whole world before this to be frivolous, superficial, ephemeral."
Hmm.
Please let me go throw up now. I mean, I love you and everything, but that's a little much.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's all women could do back then was dream and hope, because they wasn't allowed to do anything else. So, you know.
It's messed up.
Well, it's true.
Okay, so a little side note about Anne's family. Her sister, Constance, which was the youngest sister, received a letter in the mail threatening to abduct and kill her unless $50,000 was put into a specially made box in a cemetery. You might want to remember that little piece of information for later, too.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles and Anne had 6 children. From youngest to oldest, they go Reeve, Scott, Anne, Land, as in land.
Got it.
John and Charles Jr. So that's kind of where our main story picks up. Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. was the first child of Anne and Charles Sr., born on June 22nd, 1930 in Englewood, New Jersey. When Anne was 7 months pregnant with baby Charles, she went on several flights spanning over 2 weeks with Lindbergh in an open cockpit. When they returned, she was immediately hospitalized for 4 days, and some doctors theorized that these flights may have caused some of the health issues that baby Charles was afflicted with. When he was born, he was immediately put on a special diet. His head was larger than what the doctors considered normal, and he had what appeared to be signs of rickets, which is a skeletal disorder that's caused by a lack of vitamin D, calcium, or phosphate. These nutrients are important in the development of strong, healthy bones, and people with rickets may have weak and soft bones, stunted growth, and in severe cases, skeletal deformities.
So he had a very large head, like his father. Okay. Just, you know. But he was handsome. But go ahead, continue.
So he was given a special diet and a daily dose of vitamin D that the Lindberghs thought might make him more healthy. When we move on to the kidnapping, we're going to go through kind of a timeline of events. When Charlie was reported missing, it instantly became international news. On March 1st, 1932, around 9 p.m., Charles Lindbergh Jr. was kidnapped from the nursery on the second floor of the Lindbergh's home around Hopewell, New Jersey. The nanny, Betty Gow, reported the child missing at around 10 p.m. So sometime between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. on that Tuesday, one or more people came to the right side of the house with a homemade ladder and entered the baby's room through a second story window, which was left unlocked. They might have silenced him because no one heard him cry or struggle when everyone in the house was...
When you say silenced, you mean like...
You know, no.
Killed him right
no,
there?
No. Okay. Like, they could have put a cloth over his mouth or...
I got you.
Just, like, rendered him unconscious somehow.
Rendered him unconscious. Knocked him out.
Or, like, chloroformed him or something.
But you don't know.
Was that a thing? No, no one knows.
Okay. All right.
No one knows. Okay. So, everybody in the house was awake at the time. The mom's room was directly across the hall. The nanny's room was right beside
his. Were they all drunk? I mean, you know.
No, they were just...
hear a ladder, you know, like an Animal House. Boom, boom. On the No, didn't happen that way?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Animal House. They searched the premises after he was discovered missing, and traces of mud were found on the nursery floor and some footprints, but they weren't really identifiable, were found under the nursery window. On the windowsill, a ransom note demanding $50,000 was found, and the ladder, which had been used to reach the window, was in two sections, indicating the ladder broke during the ascent or the descent. No bloodstains or adult fingerprints were found at the scene, despite staff pointing out areas in the room that they hadn't touched recently. So they had obviously wiped it clean. There were no fingerprints. On March 6th...
Or wore gloves.
Okay.
Okay.
They wore gloves. On March 6th, a second ransom note was found that increased the ransom to $70,000. On March 8th, a third ransom note was found by the Lindbergh's lawyer stating that the kidnappers would only communicate with Charles and Anne and would not accept a mediator. So then enters Dr. John Condon. He was a retired schoolteacher from the Bronx who idolized Charles Sr. and placed an ad in the local newspaper offering to be a mediator between the Lindberghs and the kidnappers. That's not super weird or anything. Just a random civilian injecting themselves into the investigation.
Just
for...
wanting to be helpful.
Yeah, exactly. Sure, probably. So, on March 9th, a fourth ransom note stated that Dr. Condon would be an acceptable go-between for the kidnappers, even though they had previously said that they would only talk to Charles and Anne. On March 12th, a fifth ransom note received by Condon delivered by a taxi driver from a random stranger on the side of the road who just gives taxi drivers ransom notes actually led to a sixth ransom note where it instructed Condon who to meet with and where to meet to discuss payment. So he met some guy in a cemetery. He said it was really dark. He couldn't see them. And they had a thick German accent.
But the police had nothing, had no involvement so far?
Well, we're going to get to that. But basically, Charles didn't want the police involved. This kind of goes back to his kind of self-image where he thinks he's better than everybody else and he's the one who can handle it.
It probably stemmed from a complex, though, of how ugly he thought himself was. Anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're not hung up on that or anything.
No.
Okay. On March 16th, an article of baby Charles's clothing was delivered as proof that the kidnappers actually had the child, and it was identified as his by Charles and Anne. March 21st, an eighth ransom note was received stating that the kidnapping had been planned for over a year. They received a total of 15 letters from the kidnappers. On April 2nd, Lindbergh and Condon met a man claiming to be the kidnapper in a Bronx cemetery. There's the cemetery again.
Yeah, got it.
Okay. Condon gave the man the ransom, $50,000, and marked U.S. gold certificates. Now, if you know anything about U.S. currency, you know that in 1933, we were taken off the gold standard. And so gold certificates were basically worth a quarter on the dollar at that point. and that's all you could get for them. If you had gold certificates, you could take into the bank, and they'd give you about a fourth of what they were worth. So they were really hard to just casually get rid of because most people had turned theirs in when they switched.
Right, I got you.
Okay. So a kidnapper produced a note saying that Charles Jr. was on a boat along the Massachusetts coast. Although Lindbergh flew over that region for several days, he never actually located the boat in question. So they paid the ransom.
You said that, yeah.
Lindbergh wouldn't allow them to allow the police to stake out the cemetery or try to follow this guy or figure out where he was going, supposedly because he was scared of anything happening to his son.
Right.
Okay. So, on May 12th, the body of Charles Lindbergh Jr. was discovered 2.5 miles south of the Lindbergh house from where he was kidnapped, and about halfway between Highfields and the farmhouse that Lindbergh had rented in Mount Rose. It was clear that the baby had been murdered by a blow to the head the night he was taken. The killer showed familiarity with the area and placing the dead child in a shallow grave about 50 feet from the road in dense woods while in total darkness. It takes a lot of resources to care for a baby. However, it is easier to just kill the baby and pretend it's alive, take the money and get away, right? So,
well, I mean, that would be easiest to do with baby or not baby or, you know, child or adult even. Yeah. You know, you could do the same thing, but that's tragic. That's terrible.
Yeah, it was really, really sad, actually. The whole country was affected by the news of it. It was all over every newspaper the next day after he was found. So one side of the skull had a fracture that went from the soft spot on top of his head to behind his left ear. And then on the right side of his head, there was a hole that looks like an object, like a hammer or something, was used to hit him behind his ear. So if he was laid on the ground and hit over the head hard enough, that would explain both of the injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the coroner said that he could not identify the almost mummified remains, Lindbergh, looking at the body, said, "I am perfectly satisfied that this is my child." And then he ordered it cremated the very next day. So the biggest piece of evidence that we have in this case, Lindbergh has completely destroyed the next day. So his wife has no time to mourn or bury her child, and they've gotten rid of any kind of forensic evidence that we might have gathered from the body. So the case lay dormant for more than 2 years, and even though the investigation was ongoing, they were following the money, and the gold certificates were showing up randomly along the eastern coast. Despite Lindbergh's objection, the police had actually allowed bank officials to record the serial numbers. So there's a lot of things that we see him doing throughout the investigation of his son's kidnapping and then afterwards to hinder the process, whereas normal people would have wanted police to trace the money and stake out the cemetery and do all these things. Right. He didn't want any of that from the police.
Kind of like, you know, Cobain's wife.
That's anyway, a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, it is. But still.
Yeah, basically like that. He believed that he was smarter and better than the police and he could do it better than them. So he didn't want their help.
Or he was completely covering for an inside thing.
The money used to pay the ransom was, as I said, gold certificates.
Yes.
So a gas station clerk has a guy come through and pays for $10 in gas with a $10 gold certificate. And he's kind of sketched out by this because he's like, hey, if the bank doesn't take this, then I'm on the hook for $10. And
which was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Back then.
It really and was.
That's a lot of gas because it was what, 15 cents a gallon?
If
$10
that,
worth of
yeah.
gas? What was it?
I don't know.
Gas truck filling up a gas truck?
Maybe he got change back.
Okay.
I don't know. All I know is he gave him a $10.
It's details. It's details. I go with details. Okay. So carry on.
You need to have a seat.
Go.
Okay. So he writes down the guy's license plate number. Just in case the bank doesn't take it, he can track this guy down. Kind of like when you write a personal check these days and they're like, really, who writes checks anymore? Kind of the same thing. So when he turned this information over to the police tracked down the guy's license plate number and they found Bruno Richard Hauptmann. Hauptmann was a German immigrant who lived in the Bronx and worked as a carpenter. And when they searched his home, they found $14,000 of the ransom money and a small handgun. So $14,000 is approximately one-third of the ransom money.
Uh-huh.
So where are the other two-thirds, right? He must have had some accomplices. Richard claimed that he received the money from a friend who asked him to hold on to it while he went home to Germany. However, that friend later died and was never questioned by the police. The kidnappers communicated with Lindbergh, like I said, with 15 handwritten notes. Although they seem to be written by a couple of different people, handwriting experts actually compared them and found that they matched Hauptmann's writing and some letters that they found at his house. And they also thought that the notes were written by a German immigrant based on the way that they wrote the number signs after the dollar amounts and the way that a few of the words were misspelled. So, Hauptmann was arrested and put on trial for the murder of baby Charles. This was the biggest trial that had ever taken place in the United States at the time. It was January of 1935, and thousands of people showed up to the trial. They were covering the lawns of the courthouse. They were trying to get in and see everything. There were reporters. It was like the OJ trial out there. So, he presented himself as an innocent working man. And he actually had a criminal record from Germany. He once used a ladder to climb to the second story of the mayor's house in the village that he was from and steal money. And he also mugged two women pushing baby carriages. So that gave the prosecution plenty of evidence to show that A, he had no regard for the life of mothers or children, and that B, he was pretty confident in A, using ladders to commit crimes, and B, committing crimes against high-profile members of society.
Well, and C, don't leave out C, that they found a third of the money in his possession.
Well, sure, because, you know, money.
Yeah, I just said that.
No, yeah, that was important. Sorry. So, the prosecutors claimed that Hauptmann built the ladder because, like I said, he was a carpenter. It was sophisticated, but it was also pieced together from random pieces of wood because it was kind of a telescopic ladder. It had three different sections that got bigger as it went up, so it was easier to carry. A master carpenter at the time took the ladder, numbered each piece of wood, and then proceeded to trace their origins. He connected one piece of the ladder, which was called board 16. He connected that piece of the ladder to floorboards in Hauptmann's attic. And one of the floorboards that was missing perfectly matched the wood grain pattern from that board of the ladder. So to them, they basically had him dead to rights.
Yeah, sounds it.
On February 13th, 1935, the jury convicted Hauptmann. So that was just over a month after the trial began, which murder trials these days take ages and ages.
Well, some do and some don't.
For the most part. I mean, with this kind of...
A month is about right. I'm just saying.
Okay. You're right. I'm not doubting you. I'm just saying.
Anyway, but I mean, it just depends on, you know, how long the trial takes, but... So they convicted him.
Convicted him for the kidnap and murder of baby Charlie and sentenced him to death in the electric chair. The police were convinced that he didn't work alone, and up until the very day before he died, they kept asking him and asking him to give up his accomplices, but he never did.
What did you, now back up, you said something about cologne. You said the police worked alone. Oh, right. Sorry. I misunderstood.
I talk fast sometimes. Sorry.
I was like, what's cologne got to do with
it? They worked alone.
Okay. What? It's a fair question.
Okay. So, they kept asking him to give up his accomplices, and he never did, because then he would have to admit that he was guilty of the kidnapping, which he, again, never did. A newspaper actually offered his family $100,000 if he would name his accomplices, but even with that, he remained silent. And so, on April 3rd, 1936, just 4 years after the kidnapping, after multiple appeals, he was electrocuted. And, like I said, proclaimed his innocence up until...
until they, zapped him.
Right. So that's not unheard of for people to keep claiming their innocence, even though, you know, we may find out after they're executed that they are guilty. It's a big thing about saving the family name and preserving, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he had other accomplices, they might have, you know, been, it might have been agreed upon if you are caught, you know, and you reveal us, you know, we're going to wipe, you know, we have whatever, going to kill your whole family. Yep. And blah, blah, blah.
That's true. So that evidence against him was mostly, in my opinion, circumstantial evidence.
How was it circumstantial?
Because he had the bank notes. Right, he had the money. But outside of that, you didn't have any forensic evidence. Handwriting analysis now is a little sketchy. So even back then, I don't know that I would have bet my life on the handwriting analysis.
The lumber that was from his place for the ladder. No?
It's a piece of wood.
Okay.
I don't know. But there are alternate theories, as there are in every case.
Okay.
The main one that I'm going to talk about is the theory that it was an inside job. So, we talked about how Charles Lindbergh Sr. was a big German supporter before the war. Well,
lots of people were part of the Nazi Party before they realized, before it turned bad, but before that, and communists too in this country, you know, you had lots of people that agreed with a lot of that thinking. But anyway, I interrupted you. Continue.
It's okay. When he was informed that his son was not in his crib, Charles Lindbergh raced up the stairs and announced, "They have stolen our baby." Those were the first words out of his mouth. So even before searching the house for the toddler, he had planted the seed that his son had been kidnapped. The house itself wasn't completely finished, so the family didn't normally visit during the week, and they would typically visit on the weekends. This was actually the first Tuesday night that they had ever spent in the house, so how did the kidnappers know that they would be there? Their other house was actually very well guarded and secure, and this house was not. So this house would have been the best opportunity to... Right. Take the child versus...
Well, what would be the motivation? Why would he want...
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm getting there.
So we are going to get to that. Okay. Go ahead.
You got somewhere to be?
No.
Okay. So was he involved? He didn't trust the police. He handled all the negotiations and ransom notes himself. But like you asked, why would he want his child gone? One word. Eugenics. You know what eugenics is. Do you want to explain to the... Okay, I will.
I know, but I think you should explain.
Okay, so a huge part of Nazi Germany's philosophy was eugenics, the practice of selective breeding, where the physically and genetically inferior, and I use inferior in air quotes, were sterilized. If baby Charles was really afflicted with rickets, then Lindy would have been afraid of being seen as genetically inferior. It wasn't unusual for wealthy families of the time to have children who were seen as less than perfect, whether that be mental conditions, physical conditions, whatever.
The Kennedys, you know, they stuck her in a home and hid her. What's her name? Anyway, that's another story. But yeah. Well, they did.
No, I know.
Anyway, but yeah, it was the thing to do back then.
Yeah, so they would either put their kids in institutions or adopt them out, kind of, you know, that didn't happen, let's try again type situation. After World War II, this is just a little more about him. After World War II, he returned to Germany and assumed a fake identity. His last name was Kent, and he actually fathered 7 children with 3 different German women. And this is a pretty standard eugenic tactic. He is spreading his superior DNA around as much as possible in hopes of creating the superior race. He could have just wanted his child gone to preserve the family image, and the death may have been accidental. He would have been able to tell the kidnappers where they would be and when they would be at the Hopewell House and when would be the best time to actually execute the kidnapping. So we talked about how he didn't want the police involved. J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI, actually sent 2 FBI agents to consult on the investigation, and Lindbergh sent them away. And he already had the New Jersey State Police reporting to him with any information they found, and he threatened to shoot any officer who didn't follow his protocol. So he was keeping the investigation very close to the chest and not letting...
Yeah, he was controlling it completely.
Exactly, because maybe he wanted to control any information that was in or out.
I don't think it's a maybe. I think that's exactly what he did by what, you know, you're telling me.
So on May 23rd, this was after the baby was found, the Morrow family maid, the Morrow being Anne Morrow and her family, the Morrow family maid, Violet Sharp, committed suicide rather than face more questioning about her possible involvement in the baby's death. And she was one of the few people who knew that the Lindberghs would be staying at that house that night on March 1st.
And who's she?
She was the maid for the Morrow family, for Anne's family, mom.
Okay.
And she was questioned twice by police because she was one of the only people. So they theorized that maybe she had given out some personal information to maybe the wrong people, or she knew something about the kidnapping and felt bad about it. And she actually, when the police showed up at her house to question her the third time, she drank a bottle of silver polish before they could question her, which has cyanide in it, and died instantly. So that's a little drastic if maybe you didn't have anything
with it.
Yeah. So the night of the kidnapping, Lindbergh left instructions that his son was supposed to be put to bed at 8 o'clock and that no one should disturb him or enter the nursery until 10 o'clock. And that seems super specific because he was kidnapped during that.
You can't guarantee the baby's not going to wake up crying or...
Exactly. Just don't go in there. Don't look at the baby for 2 hours.
Was he quoted as saying till 10?
That is from the people in the house, like when they were interviewed by the police.
Okay.
That night, he was actually scheduled to attend an NYU alumni dinner, and he was known to be punctual and always reliable to any commitment that he had. But he blew this dinner off and did not show up or call to cancel on the night that his son was taken. Nobody really knows why, or obviously he was at the house, but he just didn't go to this event for some reason. While they were in the...
What do you mean for some reason? His son got kidnapped.
No, but this event was scheduled...
Prior to the kidnapping, yes, he just no-showed.
Right, exactly. No call, no show.
No call, no show. Well, you're fired. I mean, wait a minute. Wrong.
That's word. A different.
I know.
Get out of chef mode. Oh, okay. He's a chef, by the way, if you guys didn't.
anyway,
go ahead. So while they were in the parlor, just hanging out, I guess all the people that were at the Lindbergh house that night, he reportedly told Anne that he heard the sound of wood snapping outside, yet Anne and the three servants said that they heard nothing, and the dog wasn't barking, like it wasn't disturbed at all, didn't act like it heard anything outside. Actually, a few weeks before the kidnapping happened, Lindbergh, who was kind of a famous prankster, and his pranks were a little dicey on the, you know, maybe we shouldn't do that side. He took the child out of the crib one night and hid it in the closet. And
I mean, we got to realize there was no television. Nobody was on their phone.
Super bored.
Just bored out. What am I doing? I'm staring at this non-makeup wearing heinous woman. And, you know, and I'm listening to 14 of my screaming kids. No, stick them in the closet. Okay, hell, I'd do that.
He only had one, and it was asleep.
Oh, that's right. He had 14 legs.
He was just bored and just fucking with the staff, I guess.
Go fly a plane. Anyway.
Okay, so he took the baby out of the crib, hid it in the closet to freak out his wife and the nurse or the nanny that he had been kidnapped. Which seems a little on the nose.
Well, yeah.
Don't you think? Okay, yeah. So he did these kind of pranks all the time, and his pranks were always kind of over the top, like, this isn't just your normal April Fool's prank, this is a little offensive, could you not do this anymore? And after his child was killed, he never did another prank ever again. So some people theorize that it could have been a prank that went wrong. Like, maybe he was trying to joke around and say that the kid was kidnapped again and he accidentally killed it. So, whoops.
Oops.
Yep. We'll just frame it as a kidnapping. Yeah. It's fine. That's totally normal.
Well, I mean, everything points to that it was something obviously was awry. I mean, you know, him, you know, keeping the police at a stick's distance, you know, controlling the investigation to that, you know, and then, turning away the FBI with all their resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like the FBI, but, you know, if somebody kidnapped you.
He didn't mean that. Yeah. He likes the FBI.
No, I don't.
Can we not?
Okay.
Get murdered?
My point is, I would use every resource, you know, that I could, and that was his first. It just stinks. That's what it does.
So the theory with that goes that he snuck up the side of the house to fake kidnap his baby, and the ladder broke, and the baby fell and died, and then he covered it all up with a kidnapping story.
Well, you would have to be more planned out. No, that doesn't really hold water to me, because if it was a prank gone wrong, okay, fine. He would rush his his child to the doctor or something. You know what I mean? I don't agree with that theory.
Well, if the baby died, then wouldn't it make sense that you covered it up instead of becoming, you know, going from being the hottest household name to being the pariah that accidentally killed your kid doing a prank?
I mean, I kind of would think more along the lines of, you know, he was, you know, had a big old head and rickets, you know. And he didn't want that stuck on him, so.
And so he was getting rid of the kid and it died.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay, so that is kind of...
Could you imagine going to school? You know, Lindenberg, they would have called him Hindenburg Head. I mean...
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
That didn't even...
He did the kid a favor, okay?
Jesus Christ.
I'm kidding, but seriously.
No, okay, he's a little offensive at times, and I'm so sorry. He doesn't mean it, and that's all I know to say for that.
Carry on.
Yes, carry on. So that's basically the case of the Lindbergh baby. I know that it wasn't, you know, the best planned out, but we're going to get better at it every time. And
absolutely, we will. Or we'll replace her, and we'll find a new, more interesting
wife? A new, more interesting wife?
About that.
Oh, God, jeez. Okay, well, thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we have a Facebook page called A Matter of Crime, a historical true crime podcast that you are more than welcome to follow us on and get updates about what we're doing and give us case suggestions. And, yeah, so thanks for sticking it out through this.
We'll get better. Hang in there.
Like I said, we'll get better.